You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey folks, the Other People podcast is offered freely. Every episode is available for free, nearly 600 episodes and counting. If you want to support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. You can also rate and review the show at iTunes. That helps the cause. Thanks very much. Okay.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Dude, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible seeing your head exploded, seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
Hey, everybody, how's it going? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. How are you out there, wherever you are? Are you doing okay? I hope you're well. I have Chris L. Terry back on the program for a second time. He is celebrating the publication of a new novel called Black Card. It's available from Catapult Press, and it was just good to see him and to catch up and commiserate, find out where he is in life and in art. That conversation is coming up in just a moment. I got a letter from a listener named Keegan. He writes, "Hi, Brad. You were mentioned in a recent episode of the Brett Easton Ellis podcast. You come up at the 1 hour, 20-minute, 45-second mark. It's an interview with Annika Chayan." Apologies to Anna if I've just mispronounced her name. Co-host of the popular lefty podcast Red Scare. They are talking about a liberal overreaction to Trump. And he brings up your name. "For the record, I disagree with Ellis completely here. I just thought it would be interesting for you. He does call you very handsome, which is fun. Love the show. All the best. Keegan." So, thanks, Keegan. I appreciate it. And I got this email when I was out of town last week on vacation. So I haven't had a chance yet. I'm just back into town now, and I haven't had a chance to listen. But subsequently, I did receive word from multiple people telling me essentially the same thing. And from what I gather, it's a relatively benign mention. Like, Brett is just talking, you know, Brett, who believes that, you know, the resistance is a, like, out of proportion overreaction, is on one side of the line. I believe Trump is an existential threat, and that's our difference of opinion, which... for those of you who might be new to the show, Brett Easton Ellis and I got into a long conversation on this podcast in episode 587 back in July. So if you want to hear that, just listen to episode 587. I think that's what, you know, he's obviously referencing in his own show. So thanks, Keegan, for the heads up. I appreciate it. Thanks to Brett Easton Ellis for the name drop and for thinking that I'm handsome. I don't know how to process that. I also want to say thank you to everybody out there who is listening to this program. The month of August, this month, is shaping up to be the biggest in the history of the show by a very good margin. And in general, over the course of this summer, the listenership numbers have exploded. To the degree that I got freaked out about it. And I even contacted the company that hosts the back end for the show. And I was like, is something wrong? Are bots attacking my show? Why is this happening? Why are people listening to this show like this? This can't be real. And they were like, no, everything's good. It's just people are listening. Not that people didn't listen before, but there's just been such a massive spike that it's unusual. And I appreciate it. So, you know, I'm almost, the show is almost entering its ninth year of existence. I've been at this for a long time, almost 600 episodes. I don't really pay that much attention to numbers. It's not something that I fixate on. I don't think you really can if you're doing literary stuff. I think that's a great way to be miserable, or, you know, it's just a great way to be miserable in general, is to fixate on numbers constantly. But I do, you know, I do look every once in a while to see how things are going. And typically over the history of the show, over these past 8 years, it's been slow and steady growth. And then suddenly there's just been this massive upswing, which is gratifying and a little spooky. Like, why is this happening? Maybe it's hit some sort of a critical mass at nearly 600 episodes. But whatever the case, if you've been listening for a long time, thank you. If you're new to the show, welcome. Thanks for listening. And in particular, I think if you're out there and you are kind enough to talk about the show, if you like it, on social media and elsewhere, that really helps. I think that's got to be a big part of it. And hopefully the trend continues. We'll see. But it's looking good, and I appreciate it. So my guest today is Chris L. Terry. His new novel, Black Card, is available now from Catapult Press. Just a wonderful conversation, and great to catch up with him. Here he is, folks. This is Chris L. Terry.
Yeah, I remember I managed to not have a hangover for maybe the first 9 months that my kid was alive. And then that first hangover, I was like, oh, yeah, no, we just don't do that anymore.
No, I'm not changing a diaper with this, you know, raging headache.
Yeah.
So is this the first book you've published since the last book?
It is, yeah.
It is, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, and no judgment, you're talking to somebody who's been working on a book for like more than a decade. But
wow.
You had a kid, which will throw a wrench into anybody's writing routine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did you have trouble? Did you go through a period where you just, like a long period where you just didn't work because you were doing childcare stuff? And
I did the opposite in that I forced myself to work when it maybe was not productive. That first year I managed to get, right before, my kid is named Felix, and right before he was born, I'd completed a really sloppy first draft of this book. So this would have been summer 2014. And then I spent the next year working on another one that refined the story a little bit, but like considering the amount of energy, time, and stress, it might have been better to be easier on myself, you know?
Yeah, you have this big change coming in your life, and you're like, I'm not going to let go of the writing.
Yeah,
you sort of hang on tight. I get that. You know, you want to try to muscle through.
Yeah, I'm super regimented. So I was, the kid was coming and it's kind of an unknown, and I'm like, I'm never going to run again. I love to run. I'm never going to like sleep. I'm never going to write. And none of those things are true. I still found time to do all those things. I just don't have hangovers anymore.
No, the legend of this podcast, I always talk about this whenever I'm talking to somebody, not even necessarily on this show, but about like, you know, having a child and how that's going to change their routine, especially around creative work. And I'm like, listen, I'll never forget interviewing Amy Bender, and she had young twins, and she's like writing her next collection or her next book in like 10-minute increments.
Sheesh. That's why she's Amy Bender.
Yeah. She had like 10-minute sessions where she would just like force herself to sit there and just like, you know, get words down. And bit by bit by bit, she was like doing it.
And I think there is something to be said for I call it keeping the engine warm, you know, so you can just dive back in if you have those 10 or 15 minutes. I know some people that work that way. Yeah.
I have to like, I feel like I need to get better, like sharper in my approach, but I feel like I need all this warm up time. Like I can't just like jump in for 10 minutes and jump out and like, I guess maybe I can, and I just don't think I can, but that seems hardcore. Like I sort of need to give myself a moment. Dick around on Twitter for an hour, you know, like flip through a book.
Yeah. That was, before I became a parent, I realized that like, even on the day when I had all day to write, I'd probably only bang out about 90 minutes worth of work because I'd like be jogging and screwing around on social media and all that stuff.
So how much are you running?
I go running 3 or 4 times a week, like 4 to 6 mile runs. And I go swimming once too. I started learning how to do that in case I messed up my knees.
It's good. I think it's good. I'm an advocate of mixing it up, especially as you like get into middle age. I think repetitive stress, doing the same thing over and over again, no matter what it is, can tend to wreak havoc.
Yeah, I'm scared of that.
And swimming, isn't swimming like the best exercise ever?
It's, yeah, different resistance because you're not really hitting anything. You're just pushing against the water.
But like also like really like cardio intensive. Like swimming is exhausting.
Yeah, I could probably run. I could go for a run right now for like an hour, but like I probably couldn't swim five laps in a row.
So are you doing like real swimming? Like you wear a Speedo when you go in?
No Speedo. I just wear like an ordinary swimsuit.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Terry does not wear a Speedo when he swims. Not yet, anyway.
I go to the pool at the college where my wife is a professor, and I'm just immediately humbled by all the really ripped water polo players that are practicing like 10 feet away.
Yeah, those are people who are actually in shape.
Yes.
Everybody else is, you know, you try to play that sport without any foundation. Like, I'd probably drown. You'd have to fish me out of the water.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool, man. And then, you know, your book, I feel like your book speaks to, and I did not have time to like listen to our first conversation and like brush up, but from what I recall, I feel like a lot of what is in Black Card was in our conversation that first time around, like when I was learning about your life and upbringing.
Yeah.
It feels like a lot of that is fused in. Am I misremembering?
I didn't have time to listen either, but I do remember talking about that a lot too.
So why don't you let's give listeners like a brief overview then of just like where, because I don't want to do the same conversation twice, but I do think it's helpful when we're talking about your book to just have people be oriented in like your upbringing.
Sure.
You're biracial. Mm-hmm. That factors into the book. Can you just give like the 30,000 foot view?
Yeah, of course. I was born in 1979. I have a black father from Richmond, Virginia, and an Irish American mother from the Boston area. We lived in Boston until I was 15, and then we moved to Richmond, where I went to high school and college. And at the time, I was also playing in punk rock bands and traveling the world, or traveling North America and Europe, so some of the world. And to those of you out there in podcast land who can't see, I'm on the paler side. I have like kind of whitish skin, freckles, curly red hair, blue eyes. So to a lot of people, I look like a white man. To other people, I kind of look like Kid from Kid and Play. If you're of a certain age, like if you're 35 plus, I kind of favor Kid and Play in coloration. You could say Kid and Play with an MFA. My first book, Zero Fade, doesn't deal with mixed race identity. It's like a coming of age story about a middle school kid's misconceptions about adulthood and masculinity. One of the main conflicts is that the kid's a homophobe in a like teenage boy type of way. He thinks it's like gay guys are gross, and his favorite uncle is coming out of the closet.
Okay. So speaking of race, like this particular moment in American history is, I think, especially fraught. But it's always there, you know, and it's always been there since the founding of this country.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that occurred to me, not only with your book, but just generally lately, is how inescapable it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking about you, and I started thinking about being biracial and how it's like doubly inescapable for people who are embodying more than one race.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in America, it's the white-black dynamic that I think is most central to our history and to a lot of the suffering and struggles that the country has been through. And then another thing that occurs to me is the extreme delicacy around language and care around language that one needs to have to communicate about any of this effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Like one false word can muck up the works.
Yeah.
And can send things spiraling in a, you know, dramatically negative direction.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't have to tell you all this stuff, but I imagine as somebody who's written a book about this and has lived through and continues to live through this experience, you know, you must have, like, I would imagine you have a lot of feelings about it.
I mean,
you wrote a book about it.
Sure. I mean, this is definitely a stressful, unhappy time. But I think that the good side of the fraughtness, is fraughtness a word?
I think so. All right. It is here.
The upside of the fraughtness is like a lot of the concerns that I'm hearing are coming from people who maybe weren't thinking about those things before. So if you ask, I think for a lot of people of color, we already knew a lot of these things. And a lot of the static right now is coming from people who had the privilege of not having to think about that, finally starting to think about that, which is a relief. Not that I, I wish it wasn't happening this way, you know? But I think it is starting some very important conversations, and hopefully something more constructive or something more positive will come out at the end.
Well, it's externalized, a lot of which was previously kept under wraps, you know, mostly for ill. Like,
yeah,
I think we're seeing Trump having given permission or a sense of a feeling of permission and freedom for a lot of racist people,
yeah,
to fly their flag and to be openly, you know, openly racist. And
yeah,
so I think for a lot of people of color, it's no big shock.
But it's also kind of a, see, I told you this shit was racist, right, but I couldn't really prove it before.
Right.
It's so, that feeling.
I think the bigger shock is for, you know, white people in particular who are not racist, but might not have understood the depth or the scale of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so maybe in that sense, it's a positive because it's undeniable now.
Yeah.
To anybody with eyes and ears.
Yeah. And I have some thoughts about that too. I think that, that even like not having that privilege of not seeing the problem could be considered a form of racism. And one of my campaigns, as I talk about this book, is that I want to lower the bar for what's considered racist and what's talked about as racist and what is, and even the consequences of that. Cause I think, you know, you call something racist and somebody automatically goes on the defensive. But there's so much racist shit out there, that, I think just like the smaller stuff, what people call it microaggressions sometimes, aren't being addressed because it carries this weight of being called racist. And I wish that calling something racist didn't have so much weight. That's the kind of thesis of what I'm saying here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's different, it's like a spectrum, right?
I think that's kind of
what you're saying. Like there's like the really vile, hateful, like cartoonish racism almost where you're just like, whoa, like this is a dark soul.
Yeah.
But then there are people who, like you say, who, you know, maybe have blind spots that they shouldn't have.
Yeah.
But are well-intentioned generally.
Right, right.
And like, I think, like, I would call them, like, winnable. You know, like redeemable. Some of these people, like, I hate to say it, like, it's, you know, maybe they're redeemable in some ultimate sense, but boy, that's a lot of work.
Right, right.
And then there are other people where it's less work. Like, people who I think want to do the right thing, but might just be blinded by their privilege in ways that are a little egregious, but it's fixable. Like, we can work with this. And, you know, to be perfectly candid, I might fall into this camp a little bit. Like no ill intent, but just like not paying attention the way that I should have been, not seeing as clearly as I should have been.
Sure.
There's always room to improve on this stuff. And I think another like thing that your book and this subject matter generally makes me think about, even though I'm like kind of Buddhist agnostic in my orientation now, I was raised Catholic, but I think about like Christian... I think about the Christian value system in particular, like forgiveness, love thy enemy as thyself, like the meek shall inherit the earth, the sermon, you know, like all this stuff like comes to mind as I think about like, well, what are we really supposed to do? And like, what is the outcome that we're looking for? And I think in the context of maybe like, you know, cable news conversations or in especially social media conversations, it's like, well, what outcome are we aiming for? Do we want vengeance or do we want justice? And like, and if it's one or the other, like, what does that look like?
Yeah.
And I worry, I think sometimes that if it's vengeance, and that's often how it feels emotionally, which is understandable. But what I worry is that it would perpetuate. It's like violence begets violence.
Right.
Like that deeper wisdom or whatever, which is not specific to one faith tradition.
Yeah.
But it's like, wow, if we really want to create harmony and a society that's colorblind and at peace, like, how do we do that?
I'm not sure. I've been working on a freelance job where I'm researching some political history over the last maybe like century and a half. And it's interesting to see how politics, you know, it is often just like a pendulum that swings back and forth, and it's kind of like liberalism and then conservatism. And it, yeah, I don't have an easy answer for that. It's just something I was just thinking about yesterday, though.
Yeah, and it's like, I think the answer is not, I mean, I think there's politics is a big part of the answer. There has to be political action as a component of a movement towards justice, but it also is spiritual, for lack of a better word. I mean, look at the civil rights movement. I mean, who was its leader? It was like a preacher.
Yeah.
You know, who was particularly eloquent and, you know, just had all of the strength and charisma to lead it. But it
we're talking about MLK here?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But also, that. But then there's also, I mean, he wasn't the only person. I mean, I think there's like this, there's like that, the MLK versus Malcolm X sort of dichotomy.
In yeah.
Philosophically, that I think there's, you know, there's kind of been a long argument over in terms of which one is the right approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was someone was saying, told MLK that like that nonviolent shit's going to get you killed, and it did. But then again, Malcolm X didn't live either, you know. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's such tough stuff. But
yeah,
did it? Like, do you feel like from a personal identity perspective, you feel like you found solid ground? You know, as a person, I think of like, you know, like the popular culture corollary is like Obama. You know, he's like the guy who seems to have really done a lot of work, like deep work in resolving those kinds of questions, not only around his racial identity, but I think relationship to his dad, you know, that book that he wrote.
Yeah.
You could really feel that in him, that there was a solidity. He just projects such like confidence and calm, like no neurosis. Like he's not a neurotic guy at all. And yeah. As a neurotic guy, I'm like, wow, you know,
I think you need to know yourself so that you can know what to do. And it seems like he definitely wouldn't have, you know, rose the way that he did if he didn't do that work. Yeah.
Every person who seeks high public office should have to do that kind of work.
That'd be nice, huh?
Yeah. I mean, they all write books, but they don't really write them. Like that book was written, I think, crucially before he ever entered public life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was really searching. And, you know, it's a good process to put yourself through. I mean, it's hard, but it's healthy.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know that I will always have my insecurities about my identity and about where I fit in the world. But I've done a lot of work over the last 10, 11 years of my life, especially. It was something that I spent a few years leading up to that, looking for ways to do that work and finally started to find it, in my late 20s, early 30s.
How do you do it in writing or?
Yeah. Writing helped. It was first I wanted to get the hell out of Richmond, Virginia. And I moved to New York, because I wanted to be around just a better mix of people. And I felt like I was getting that there. And then I moved to Chicago to get a creative writing MFA. So I was writing, and a lot of the stuff that I was exploring in writing was stuff about like mixed race, black identity. So I was laying the groundwork for the book Black Card pretty much within, you know, my first semester of grad school. And at the same time, just completely serendipitously, at Columbia College Chicago, I got offered a student worker job in the multicultural affairs office. I just signed up for like a work study type of job, and they found my resume and contacted me. And, you know, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything on my resume that said that I really needed that, but I really needed that. So I got to be around lots of different people. And I got to know myself as a black person in Chicago, I would say, in part through that job. So thanks, Kim Weatherly, if you're listening to this. That's my old boss.
I'm wondering, you've lived in New York, Chicago, and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of the three cities, was there one that distinguished itself as being, like, the most sane on matters of race?
So I think that it's been 15 years since I moved to New York. And I think culture has changed a lot since then. So I left New York before Obama was elected. I think LA is my favorite so far. I feel like there's just, the first time I came to California, I was in my early 20s and I was on tour with my band. And I woke up one morning as I was in a punk band, with four white men. who I'm still friends with. but I woke up one morning and we were staying at someone's house, and I want to say it was Santa Barbara or Goleta, like near there. And I realized my bandmates were the only white folks there. And it was in this kind of punk rock context, which felt really overwhelmingly white. And that was my first idea that maybe coming west, there'd be things had browned a bit more, as they say sometimes. You know, people, there were more like mixed race people, more black people doing the stuff I wanted to do, and like brown people doing the stuff that I wanted to do. And I still feel like that here. Even I'm glad that my kid is having the experience of living around a bunch of different people. I went to pick him up at daycare a few months ago, and him and some of his friends were singing songs, and it was like every single kid on the rug was like a mixed race kid with slightly different heritage. Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, and you talk about like wanting to your kids to have experiences that you didn't have, and I'm really happy to be giving that to my child. I hope it helps them.
Well, it's got to be easier to grow up in Los Angeles as a mixed race child than it is to grow up in Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like you don't fully maybe feel like you belong to the white community or the black community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did you feel that? You felt that explicitly?
A bit, yeah, yeah.
Talk about that experience. It's got to be so interesting. Like, you have to have had experiences in your life where you're with a bunch of white people who don't realize maybe that you are African American.
Oh yeah, I definitely go incognito sometimes, especially like I used to have shorter hair. I think my hair is one of the main tells.
Yeah,
and I used to have really short hair. Yeah. Well, let me rewind a little bit. So we were in the Boston suburbs at first, and we were in like a Jewish enclave. So I went to school with lots of kids that, like, if you were to describe them, it could also sort of look like me, like curly hair, fuller lips, paler skin. So I wasn't, and there weren't very many black people around. I wasn't really thinking. I had the privilege of not having to think about race and identity very much until I was maybe a preteen and I started to get a sense of the world. This would have been like circa 1990 when it feels like it was a really good black pop culture era, like In Living Color and Arsenio Hall. And there was quality black art in the mainstream, I think. I also am biased because that was my age or my era. But yeah, we moved to Richmond and it was a lot more of a black-white dichotomy. So this would have been the mid-1990s, like end of the crack era. Richmond was still a really violent place, neck and neck with Gary, Indiana, usually for per capita murders. And the population was like maybe like 55% black, 45% white. I'd never really lived around black people before. And I was like, you felt good. I'm coming home. Like I'm going to get to know myself a bit more. And I think I was just deeply into some white shit that I didn't realize and like didn't really click.
What was the white shit? Like punk rock or?
Yeah, like skateboarding and the Beastie Boys and shit. And I mean, I know that's just kind of topical or superficial things, but I also hadn't had a lot of the experiences that a lot of the black people that I was meeting were having. As soon as that proved to be difficult, I kind of retreated into punk rock. And that's, you know, it's embarrassing to admit, but it was also like 2/3 of my life ago at this point. So,
well, what's embarrassing about retreating into punk rock? It's like a good place to retreat when you're an adolescent. I mean, as good a place as any.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. But I think it was me being like, this is my first chance to really get to know myself as a black person and to, deal with race head on. And I was like, or Green Day, you know, and it's like, all right, that's probably taken the easy way out.
Right.
I got some very good things out of punk rock.
But what else are you going to, like, what are you supposed to do? You know, like, and I think that's what your book is about, to try to prove your bona fides.
Yeah. Yeah. And it almost seems like being a tryhard is even worse in some ways, or that just can set you up for failure, spectacular failure, as opposed to this kind of tiptoeing away that I was doing.
Well, and it's like maybe it's not an either or, like, or a both kind of thing, but that being mixed race is just its own thing.
But that's the thing, that it isn't. That's the other pisser. Well, I don't know. It's a good thing, but it's a complicating thing, is that it isn't its own thing. It's like, there's people like me who are half black, half white, and there's all sorts of mixed race could be so many different combinations of things. And it's to the point where, like, some people don't even like to say biracial anymore, because at this point, like, someone who comes from two different heritages can be having a kid with somebody from two other heritages, and then they have a kid who isn't biracial. They're like quadracial or something. And yeah, it's evolving fast, which I think is a good thing.
I think that's what we need.
Yeah.
Like, it just needs to get to the point where it's just no longer an issue. It's, and I say this with humility, it's exhausting. Right? It's exhausting for me. It must be like 100 times as exhausting for people of color.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, for just sane people in general who just want there to be some peace and harmony, it's like here's what's exhausting about it to me is that it's so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Like racism is so, you have to be so stupid. It's like you can explain this to a 4-year-old in 5 minutes. Why is his skin peach?
Right.
Well, that's just the pigment and it's the way he's made. Why is her skin brown? Oh, it's just the pigment. But we're all the same. We all, you know, like, oh, okay. Done.
Yeah.
Like kids get it immediately. I mean, it's obviously taught. It's a learned hatred, you know, that's passed down that way. But
yeah,
it's like, it seems like it should be so much easier to remedy than it is. I think that's the frustration. It's like, we really can't get this. We can't wrap our heads around this. Like,
yeah. And I think that's ideally is kind of I want to delay or soften that kind of learning in my kid. And that's why I want him to be around a better mix of people. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, if I'd feel differently if I'd grown up somewhere else, I'll never know. Excuse me.
Yeah. The racial tension in Richmond must have been pretty pronounced. I've never spent time there, so I could be wrong. Right.
So it's different. So, I mean, Boston does not get a pass in this. Boston definitely has a lot of racism, but I think also just the culture, the way people conduct themselves is different. And we were also around like in a more kind of affluent area where people would maybe be more reserved about stuff. You know, they'd kind of bought their way into isolating themselves from certain issues. But we definitely experienced some racism in New England, but it's a lot more in your face in the South. You know, we lived, our first apartment was like, when I took a left off my parents' block, the first thing I saw was Robert E. Lee's horse's ass. Because there was a street called Monument Ave that's right there that has huge statues of 4 different famous Confederates. It's and we lived right by the Lee statue. So it's like every day it's just this reminder that, you know, that not too long ago, somebody had fought so that like people who own like him could own people who look like my family.
Yeah, why don't we knock that shit down?
I'd like that, yeah.
I mean, like that seems appropriate. Like it should have been done long ago.
Yeah, and that movement is gaining some traction, which, you know, that's what the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville 2 years ago was about that. So that there's obviously some very vociferous resistance to the idea of taking down the monuments. But yeah, I think those things should go. Yeah.
Like they're un-American.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, yeah. Like, full stop. Like, and this notion, like, Robert E. Lee was really a good man who was a very good general who just happened to be defending the rights of his state. It's like, no, motherfucker. He was fighting to destroy the Union and preserve slavery.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah. And that kind of softening perspective is really rolled into things in Virginia. And I know that it has changed, and I moved there 25 years ago. But when I was like a teenager, it wasn't Martin Luther King Day. It was Lee Jackson King Day because Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson's birthdays are right around King's. And it was, so, you know, they said, well, we want to celebrate this history too. And it's important to us, but it's like, you're also trying to diminish this, like one victory, this one thing that you've given black people. You've just put a,
they called it Lee Jackson King Day.
It was Lee Jackson King Day up until like maybe 2000.
Is that a Southern thing or is that just a Richmond thing?
I think other Southern states had similar things.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I think more broadly, like just to shift gears a little bit, like thinking about race and racism is like, I have a belief that like we all have, all of us, no matter your skin color, have racial bias.
Sure.
Clearly, like white people who are racist against people of color is the overwhelmingly, it's overwhelmingly the biggest problem and the core of the disease.
Yeah.
But if we're being honest, just as like human beings on an equal playing field, like we all have some racial bias. Like there's Puerto Ricans who are, you know, have a racial bias against blacks and vice versa. Or, you know,
<yeah.
laughs> I mean, like, it's not like this thing is exclusive to one particular,
yeah,
you know, type of person or, you know, a group of people. Like, this is just a human thing.
Yeah.
And it's something I think we got to be somewhat real about in ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to say this earlier. I'm definitely not on a high horse here. And like something I really appreciate about living here is that I'm realizing more and more of my blind spots because there's people from all over the world here and there's so much I don't know. And I find that fascinating. You know, I want to know more, and I want to exist around different people.
Well, yeah, I do too. And I also, it's like, how do I be better about widening my circle to, in an authentic way, include more people from varied backgrounds? And it can be hard to figure, you know, like, how do I make that happen?
Yeah. Because it goes back to the try hard thing I was talking about, where it's like, you don't want to like tokenize somebody and insult them and just be like, well, you're black, so I need a black friend.
Yeah.
That's like, you.
You bring a Filipino in here, you know, like, and you don't want to be like the, hey guys, how's it going? I just want to, you know, I'm trying to branch out, you know, like it's got to be real.
Yeah. I don't know what the best solution is for that. There's, Louis C.K., may he rest in peace, had one of his TV shows. He had one called Lucky Louie. It was like, I don't know, in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, and that was like his first HBO,
yeah,
like his big series that was supposed to be his breakout, but it didn't do anything.
Yeah, there was one episode where he's like trying to make friends with a black person. I think it's played by Jerry Minor, who's a really good comedian. And he finally admits to Jerry Minor that like his kid... saw a black person and said refrigerator, because the only black person they'd seen in their house was the refrigerator repairman. And Jerry Minor, his line was like, you know what, I'll do this if it means that one little white girl can tell that black people and refrigerators apart. And I thought that was a really like deft way of touching on that. Like how do you do that work in a way that doesn't, you know, continue to like insult and oppress the people who you're trying to gain a greater understanding of.
Yeah. You know? And it's like, yeah. And I think ultimately, like, there are people you get along with. It doesn't matter what their cultural or racial background is. You know it when it's happening, and you should always embrace it when it does.
Yeah.
And if it's not happening, like not for some like super toxic reason.
Yeah.
Like just like let it be.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to be friends with everybody in the world. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I think
there can be like this overcorrection type of psychology or like, or like emotional experience that I can, you know, I've been through, but I think ultimately it's just like, like certain people you vibe with, like go with it and make sure to take care of those relationships because it's important. I mean, like a friendship is really important.
Yeah.
The older you get, I don't know. It's like one of these things that's always on my mind. I feel like I need to be better at, because once you have children, you got work,
mm-hmm.
it's harder to maintain friendships.
It is.
You know, then it's like when you're in your early 20s, it's like prime time, college, whatever. You can easily do it because you don't have all these other things pulling you. But
I think you're in a good place in terms of race relations if you meet someone from another culture and you're like, yeah, I don't like that motherfucker. And it's not because like, I don't like them because they're Filipino. It's like,
right.
I don't like them because we don't get along.
Yeah, the guy's just an asshole.
Yeah.
Doesn't have anything to do like with anything racial or cultural. Like, like as long as that's coming from a pure and honest place.
Yeah.
Like that's what I think it's healthier. I don't think it's healthy to like, you know, just like seem to paint with a super broad brush and try to be like that overly woke person. You know, that feels inauthentic to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like that'll just have you riding for a fall because you're not as woke as you want to be. You're not as woke as you think you are. And someone's going to point that out if you're real loud about it. But I think also the flip side to the like getting to the place where you can admit that you don't like somebody is, you know, it is valuable to still examine, still ask yourself, make sure that you aren't being extra hard on this person because they're from a different culture.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I mean, I think that talking about retreating into punk rock, like I got to the point where I was like, just like scared to try to make friends with, 15-year-old me was scared to try to make friends with black people. So I'm like, I'm going to fuck this up. I need to do something easier. I just wasn't willing to do the work at the time.
Yeah. Well, I get that, you know, it's like, it can feel like a minefield, you know, and you don't want to make a mistake.
Yeah.
It's like being blocked or something, you know, it's like, there's a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
But
and then you get all nervous and then you really screw up.
Yeah, exactly. And it just like compounds, it snowballs. So do you feel like you can't be in a perfect equilibrium with the different racial components of yourself? Can you, like, are you equally comfortable with being white and white culture as you are with being black and black culture? Or do you feel like you tilt one way? Like, do you notice that in yourself?
I think I I'm equally uncomfortable, and that, you know, that I have concerns in either situation. So I'm at my most comfortable when there's just a variety of people around, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's not as much of like a dichotomy. It's not as stark of an issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you ever, you must be privy to, I mean, you talked a little bit about this, you know, when you referred to, how did you refer to incog?
Incognito?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but you must have been in your lifetime in situations where people were not aware of your racial identity and might have said things in front of you that they otherwise would not have.
Oh yeah. There have definitely been times where where white folks who didn't recognize me as black and started doing like anti-black racism.
And what do you do?
I usually tell them I'm black.
Yeah. And what do they say?
And then they're like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, and it kind of leads to some like, but you're different. You're not like the rest of them. And it's like, oh
yeah,
I don't need to be reminded of that.
Yeah.
You know, I might feel different on the inside than I look to you on the outside. And yeah, it's, I mean, the idea that black people can tell that I'm black, because like black people come in a lot of different colors and, you know, we can have an easier time recognizing each other. Like, If you're white, it's like being white is the norm. That's the supreme. That's the supreme thing. That's the overriding culture in a lot of ways.
Well, it's the privilege.
Yeah, and you're not going to take a moment to. You're going to assume that the other people around you have it. You know. Yeah, I'm not. Maybe not being very eloquent here. I'm sorry.
Well, no, it's the language. You know, it's hard. I think that's what I was saying at the outset. Is that like trying to language this stuff is so delicate and difficult. And, you know, I'll give an example, and I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but
you're canceled. Totally.
Yeah. I mean, but I worry, you know, it's like, again, I feel like I'm tiptoeing through a minefield and could easily be making mistakes. So
sure.
You know, I just ask everybody's patience, but like, Toni Morrison recently passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, like my Twitter feed was lit up with, you know, grief and remembrance and appreciation and eulogy. And there was a video that went viral where she is talking to Charlie Rose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw this.
Is it the one where they were like, do you think you'll write white characters? Is it?
Well, it was more like she was like, I'm not a victim. I refuse to be one, which is an awesome sentiment. And like, mm-hmm. this like expression of strength. And she said, you know, what would white people be? With it, what would the, you know, these white people be without their racism? Would mm-hmm. they be strong? Would they be smart? How would they feel? And she's basically saying, like, take me out of it. You know, it's the problem of white racists. But when she was, and I am 100% on board with the sentiment. It's an awesome clip. Mm-hmm. But there was a moment, if I'm being totally honest, where she says, white people have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of me that was just like, can we just put the word some in front of white? Like, it's not all of us. Like, is that fair? Or is that, am I being too defensive? You know what I'm saying?
I think that was a, you know, like me talking about not wanting to do the work as a teenager. I think that's still, it's not easy to do that work. And that was your instinct of being like, fuck, I have to deal with this now. And, you know, I go through a similar thing where it's like, I'm dealing with something racist. And I'm like, man, I was just like trying to get some groceries I was just trying to look at Facebook for a minute, and now I have to like say something about this, and this is nerve-wracking and exhausting, to like, you know, to call out some racism. It's, they call it emotional labor is the term that people a lot younger than me use.
So
you know?
yeah so do you think, because social media is, you know, so often so toxic, and there's just this never-ending torrent of takes and feelings.
Uh-huh.
Do you think it's been positive for people's understanding of race, or do you think it's been net negative?
Hmm. I think it's good. I think anything that has people in touch and communicating is good, even if it's, you know, people are communicating in their internet ways, or they're hiding behind a screen, and are maybe showing their worst selves. But I feel a lot more tapped into other people's experiences by looking at social media, by looking at the internet. And I know that it's a, you know, it's a performed type of experience that people are sharing on there, but it still teaches me more. I think it's still valuable. I can still feel like I at least have a sense of other lives that aren't just in my world. I don't get out a lot. You know, I work from home. I'm a parent.
That's right. That's right. I think that's true. Like, I would not have, like, for all that I kvetch about social media, without my Twitter, I would not have anywhere near the kind of window into the minds and lives of a great variety of people.
Yeah.
That I have access to because I follow like 6,000 people,
you know,
or whatever. I follow a ton of people. I don't care. You know, I'm not judicious about it. And, so it kind of washes over me.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the value. I mean, maybe that's the upside. I mean, there's plenty of negatives, but, that might be something that if I ever do bail, which I dream about doing, just checking out and living a less mediated life, like that might be something that I feel is lacking, once I'm gone.
I like being lost in that sauce. And it's like I was saying about feeling most comfortable around a variety of people. You know, I can kind of create that dream world for myself on social media a little bit. And then it also... Yeah, and also but also monitoring the way that I digest things. I was just hanging out with one of my friends a week or two ago, and we were talking about, I don't know, a few different like memes or like recurring internet jokes that we really like. We're like, but these just aren't our jokes to make for whatever reason, you know? Like, it's not going to sound good if I'm making this joke, but boy, am I going to listen to other people make it.
Right.
I'm a wise ass, and I seek out humor.
Yeah, well, your book's funny.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, but I think like... it's always hard labor to write a book, but to write a book that grapples with this stuff in the absence of humor seems like it would be that much harder.
Yeah. Yeah. It is weird. I'll be sometimes reading something and I'm like, I get this. I understand what they're doing here, but there's something wrong. And I realize that it just seems kind of humorless in a certain way. And that's definitely something that will put me off, a conversation or a piece of artwork.
So what about like doing, like you've talked a couple times about doing the work.
Yeah.
You know, this emotional labor of engaging with race and investigating our own biases.
Yeah.
Our own blind spots, our own, you know, racism, even if it's like more on like the benign end of the spectrum or like in that, if that's a way to put it.
Yeah.
But like, what does the work need to look like? You know what I'm saying? Like what practically can a person do? Because I think so many of us, like I don't want to be racist. I just want to get along with everybody.
Right.
I want to be part of the solution, but, I also don't want to overestimate where I'm at with this stuff and have like some sort of high opinion of myself when it's not merited.
Right. That's a really good question. Cause I feel like I was being a little bit catchphrasy here and trying to coast on that. But I think that, you know, the work, that kind of emotional or personal excavation, it's just, it varies on an individual basis. For me, doing the work was kind of getting to understand, any like internalized racism or white supremacy that I got by mainly being raised around white people. It was understanding certain privileges as I have as a black person who can pass for white or who presents as white to some people. You know, I don't get pulled over at random by the cops, for example. And I know that's a very big example. So doing the work was getting to taking stock of some of the privileges that I've had or some of the things that I'd internalized, that had given me biases or given me an insensitive perspective on the rest of the world. Yeah.
I mean, because that's a big one, you know, because you're lighter skinned and can pass, like just to have to move through America as a person with like darker brown skin, especially, I mean, darker brown skin, full stop, but also, you know, as a male, it's like the level of just like baseline anxiety that must bring, that's quite a thing to have to deal with.
Yeah.
That I think can miss people.
Yeah. Know? Are you familiar with Damon Young? He writes for The Root and Very Smart Brothers. He's like a cultural commentator guy.
I might have read, but I'm not like super familiar.
He's good. He's one of my favorites. And he wrote an essay. This was maybe like 5 or 6 years ago at this point, but he talked about nigga neurosis, which was where like you are asking yourself if something happened to you because you're black or just because it happened to you. So the extra layer of having to ask yourself if that was racist and how you might act differently, you know, and it's just like in any given situation. I don't know if you want that in your search history, but I say give it a look, give it a Google.
Yeah,
it's a really good read, and I thought that was a really great insight into the kind of extra step that we have to go through.
Yeah,
yeah.
Do you have hope that it'll ever? Probably not in our lifetime, but do you have hope like that things are going to get to a point where this is just in our past, like really in our past, or is it? Is it just on some continuum and it's going to be a fight we just never stop?
I think that as long as there are people who stand to benefit from having people divided, they'll find a way to divide people, and that it will probably continue to be a racial thing until people start looking different, or people all start looking the same, which might happen in 9 or 10 generations. You never know.
You never know.
Yeah.
I mean, especially I think in the cities where people of different races and cultures are living in proximity. Like, I want to say Los Angeles is like per capita the most diverse city in the world.
Oh, really?
In terms of like cultural and racial representation, like nations, you know, like I want to say.
Cool.
Well, it's so big. I mean, yeah. There's like little pockets of culture, you know, like hidden all over the place. But it's, I don't know, maybe it's like, it seems like it would happen. But then again, like, you know, you look to a place like Richmond or these cities in the South, and it feels like, is there a lot of intermarriage and relationship happening there? It feels like it would be more segregated or separate.
It's still pretty segregated. I think less now than it was when I was a kid. But something else I wanted to mention, it's also easy to get caught up in like, it's so beautiful that so many different people are living in close proximity to each other. But that doesn't mean that just because two different groups live near each other doesn't mean that they don't hate each other.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Right.
You know,
but yeah. At least like, well, it's tough because, you know, one of the ironies of the South, like I grew up in the North, I grew up in Milwaukee.
Okay.
Has plenty of racial problems that yeah. were like, maybe sort of like quieter, like more hidden.
Yeah.
But I have parents who are from Louisiana and
wow.
my ancestors are from Louisiana. Like, my dad's side, my great-grandfather he came over on the boat, so mm-hmm. it doesn't go that deep on my dad's side and my great-grandmother. On my mom's side, it runs deeper, and there might have been, I have never actually investigated this to the point where I would have like official confirmation, but it seems likely that there were like slave owners
yeah.
in my family line, which fucks with my head.
Mm-hmm.
Like having that blood in my veins, like, I don't know, like it's weird. I can feel a sense of guilt.
Uh-huh.
It's like truly like feels, it makes me like super uncomfortable, and I have a sense of responsibility around it. And I say all this without even really having total confirmation. It just seems like logical based on the time period in American history and where they were, you
yeah.
know, unless they were, you know, the quiet dissenters or something.
Like, or poor and working on a farm.
Yeah. Like fingers crossed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a kind of a. Another running joke, it's like it's easy to look back at, like, since I don't know, I can't trace my way all the way back to Africa and know what my family was doing, it's like, oh yeah, definitely, you know, they were kings and queens, my ancestors.
Right, right.
And you know, and everyone says that, anyone could say that,
and yeah, well, and
we
everyone,
weren't all kings and queens, some of us were working on that goddamn farm instead.
That's right. Or like people talking about past lives, it's always like, you know, they go see a psychic and it's always like, oh, you were Cleopatra. It's,
yeah,
it's never
yeah.
like you were like a goat herder, you know.
Yeah, you weren't doing Cleopatra's laundry, you were Cleopatra.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So but no, but I, you know, I just, it's weird to think about like generational ancestral like guilt and like what responsibility there is, because even if my forebears were like farmers and quiet dissenters in Louisiana, there are still like in my present existence aunts, uncles, deeper family,
mm-hmm.
some questionable views, shall
sure.
we say, you know, and some Trump supporting
man,
people who like, you know, it's really hard to love them, but reconcile that with the fact that they're like on board with this. Like I had these videos of these family separations and these weeping children. It's like what? Like, where's the line for people? It's
yeah.
It's really hard to parse and to know how to behave around family members who can tolerate that.
I don't know this for sure, but wasn't this always kind of going on? The deportations and family separations is just kind of being talked about now more?
Different. There were family separations happening when a parent was like truly strung out on drugs. This is my understanding of it.
Okay.
So if like the mother was like wasted and the child was endangered,
yeah,
then there would be a separation for the child's welfare.
Yeah.
But like just being like, oh, miss, we're going to have to see your baby just for a moment. And then the baby just disappears.
Yeah.
And you don't see your kid for 2 years.
Sheesh. Yeah.
Like this is different and sinister. And it has Stephen Miller's like fingerprints all over it.
Okay.
And it's, I think, very much the precursor to the kinds of like horrors that we've seen in past genocides.
Yeah.
Like not to sound like too alarmist, but I mean,
no,
it's not like these things, like you flip a switch and it starts happening at like, you know, an amplitude of 11. There's a build and a slow degradation of our like sense of morality.
Yeah.
And they wear away at it, wear away at it. And then suddenly, you know, you look up one day and you go, what the fuck has happened?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm sorry if I sounded kind of ignorant there. It's, you know, as a relatively new parent, it just makes it all the more emotional for me. So I have a hard time even just approaching it. It's so fucking upsetting.
It's horrible. And, you know, like, look, there were a ton of deportations. I think there are more deportations under Obama than there were under Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Like he enforced the border, and I'm sure it was not a completely, you know, clean process, you know, from a perspective of humanity. But things, the cruelty as a feature and not a bug has definitely taken root with Trump.
Everything does seem dumber and crueler.
Like as a feature.
Yeah.
And they celebrate it.
Yeah.
You know, that's like what's so weird and troubling and sinister about it. So, yeah, I don't even know how we got to that, but it's certainly, I think, on most of our minds, you know, especially if you're watching the news or on your computer screen too much.
Yeah.
So what about the actual, I mean, you talked a little bit at the beginning about, you know, sort of muscling through these earlier drafts of your book, in, you know, after the birth of your son.
Yeah.
Your son. So, you know, did you burn yourself out? You hit a wall where you had to take a break and then come back. Like you got through draft two, that draft where you were sort of, you know, fighting your way through it. And then what happened?
So in between drafts, I'd take a couple weeks to like, to decompress and, you know, watch TV on a weeknight or something instead of like spending that hour or two between, you know, work and putting the kids to bed and going to bed myself writing. But then I'd always get to a point where I'd feel like something wasn't right. I'd have this kind of baseline of anxiety or depression and be like, oh yeah, I need to be working on my stuff. I need to do that. And it got really bad after that second draft. This was, the fall of 2015. So I was coming to the end of my first year as a parent, which was wonderful and awesome, but also exhausting and a major life change. And I was also, I had a job that I was really unhappy in that was very depressing.
What were you doing?
I was doing copywriting work at a really poorly run company.
That'll do it.
Marketing writing. Yeah. and it wasn't like that. It wasn't like a barrage of work that was stressing me out. It was just like not enough to do and having a hard time getting any sort of results, which also translated to how I was feeling about my book. And, you know, my Zero Fade, my first book, was 2 years old at that point. So I was done promoting that and I felt very like out in the weeds. And I really wanted to come back. And that's when I started to rally. And between late 2015, and like late spring, early summer 2016, I got the book a lot more in shape. I really just feel like I made a big leap in working on it right then and started looking for an agent like summer 2016.
And you found one?
I did. Yeah. And that was, I found an agent pretty quickly.
Who's your agent?
I work with Kirby Kim at Janklow and Nesbitt. He's been fucking awesome. Yeah. He was my number one choice and I got him.
Why?
Maybe I've lived in California for too long, but I was just kind of going off my gut. Like I knew a couple of people who were represented by him, and they spoke really highly of him, and something was telling me that he was the one for me. And it's proven right. He got me right around where he helped me hit my reasonable expectations for my book, you know, I wanted to take a step up and work with like a bigger indie publisher. And I got that. You know, in the back of my head, it was also like, or maybe I'll get a $2 million advance. And I had to take a moment to mourn when that didn't happen, but I'll pay off those student loans later.
I mean, you know, there's like, how many people get that a year? I wonder how many of those deals for literary fiction or literary nonfiction actually happen. I'd love to see somebody keep track.
I saw a list of some of the like biggest book advances, and most of them go to like celebrities who are writing a book. So I'm not a known quantity outside of this.
But every once in a while, there's like that debut novel that all the publishers are fighting over.
Yeah. And my haterish kind of sour grapes thing to say is that that's a whole lot of pressure also. And there's like, it's almost impossible to make back that advance. So it's going to be hard to sell your next book.
Right. But that's how we make ourselves feel better.
Yeah. I'd love to have that problem, man.
Right.
Yeah. I got those student loans, like I said.
Oh my God. So you got the agent, you went out, got the, like, how long did it take for it to sell? Did you have to wait a long time or?
Oh, so, I officially signed on with Kirby, like fall of 2016. And he had me editing the book for a while. We worked on it for about 9 months. He started chopping it summer of 2017. So almost an entire year went by. And it sold. It got to the... It took like 3 or 4 weeks to sell, to the point where I think he was getting a little bit nervous.
It's not that long, though.
Oh, yeah. It happened, but we... it wasn't like, oh, damn, there's a bidding war immediately.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, like, if things go, I mean, it, you know, people can preempt, and it's not necessarily going to mean, like, life-changing money, but
yeah.
It seems like when things sell, it typically happens fast.
Yeah.
When good things happen, they tend to happen quickly.
Yeah.
When it comes to the sale of art, and same thing's true in film.
Yeah.
You know, it's rarely, like, a six-month process where people are deliberating.
I think we were getting to the point where it was on the precipice of not being happening fast. And so my agent was getting nervous, and I was like, still pretty new to the process. I was like, I don't know, is this good?
Blissful ignorance.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you weren't like freaking out about it.
I'm always freaking out about everything, but I also didn't want to get in his way, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's an entire, sometimes this is a good thing, but I had some distance from the process. I kind of like fed my manuscript into a machine, and it's being sold to these other people who are working with these people who know these publicists, who know these people in media, and it's really cool that this is all happening. But it also, you know, it means that what I'm making is a commodity, and it's kind of interchangeable.
And it's like, once it's out of your hands and, you know, out into the world, it's out of your hands.
Yeah. And I can let these pros do it, and they'll get way better results than I would if it was just me emailing people. Yeah. And I appreciate the hell out of it. It's been awesome.
Yeah. It's nice to have some help.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. You wrote the fucking thing. Like, it's makes, you shouldn't have to do it all. I mean, like, that's the thing about it. It's like this kind of like cruel reality, especially, you know, when you're more of a, you know, quote unquote entry level writer, or you're like really on a micro press, or you're publishing yourself, or, mm-hmm. you know, you're just dealing with limited resources in whatever context it happens to unfold, is how much of the responsibility falls on the writer. Not necessarily like explicitly, like no one gives you like a list of things to do, or maybe your publisher does, but it's more like if you don't do it, no one will.
Yeah.
And so it's like such a relief and a joy, I think, to have any help in the process, even an agent just like taking the time to read and like offer, like, you know, considered notes and feedback is like, you know, such a relief and so appreciated. And to get like a professional copy edit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a nice process, like saving you from yourself. You know?
It is. And it's such a, I come from, like I mentioned before, this kind of punk rock background where I am like, was making, you know, like handshake record deals and like touring in a van and doing a lot of stuff myself or with my friends. And so that's my instinct, is to just like be pretty assertive and to try to do stuff. So a few times where I was like, I really need to like sit back and let these people cook, because they're the pros, and I'm really excited to see the results I'll get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you still play music?
I don't. But I'm thinking I might. I love music. I'm still a music geek. I think I'm going to wait to start a band until my kid is old enough to be embarrassed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like another 7 or 8 years.
Just like a dad band.
We'll see where I'm at. Yeah.
What instrument do you play again?
I was singing in most of the bands I was in, but I could play a little bit of everything.
So you can sing.
No, I can shout. I can't really sing.
You're like screamer? Is that what you're doing?
More of that, yeah.
Oh, wow. You don't seem like, I can't, it's hard to picture.
Oh, either there's, I have a calm exterior, but I'm pretty neurotic.
You got some rage?
Maybe more when I was younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's just like fatigue.
Yeah.
Now I'm just fucking exhausted.
Weariness. Yeah.
So what about, what are you working on now? Like, you got another book in the works, and like, are you working a day job? Like, or is the writing the thing?
Yeah. So, things are very transitional right now. Book wise, I have about half of a decent draft of another book, like a YA book about, a kid who's having a series of mysterious seizures while going through a breakup. And he's kind of like blaming his ex for the health problems. So I'm trying to kind of interrogate like that kind of sad boy, toxic masculinity. I haven't touched it in a couple months. The other, professionally, my life has just been changing. I was doing copywriting work. I got laid off in April. So about 4 months ago, and I've started doing more freelance work now. I'm on a big project. I'm for an agency, like helping to write a political podcast, like working with these journalists to help shape their story.
That's cool.
I'm not sure how much of it I'm supposed to spoil surprise wise. So I'm sorry if I'm being like a little obtuse here or something.
No,
yeah, but
it's
a big step up. Instead of working in marketing, it's something I really want to do, and I'm hoping it opens a door. So it's another layer of pressure right now. You know, I have the excitement and the worries of having a book coming out, and then I'm also like having a bit of a career change that I really want to succeed at because it's really exciting and engaging.
Well,
so
and,
those are the two things I'm doing right now.
And it also seems like the kind of gig that there would be some symbiosis with creative writing and pursuits.
Yeah.
Like, are you in office every day or?
No, I'm working remotely. Which I was 9 to 5 before in an office. So even that's been a transition. It's been a nice transition, but it's, you know, a few weeks in I had to remind myself, it's like, just as I'm not at the office doesn't like, if I go take a yoga class at lunchtime and it takes 2.5 hours, that means I have to work at night. You know,
yeah.
There are still only so many hours in the day.
Right.
But at least I'm not like
I'm there
driving to Santa Monica every morning or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think a little bit of both is sort of good. Like, if you work from home too much, you can sort of get isolated and, you know, maybe lazy or lazier, or you just don't have as much when there's not as much external pressure on your schedule. You know, it's easy to slip a little bit, and it's good, I think, to have to engage with other human beings in a professional context.
Yeah, absolutely. I do like some structure.
But not too much.
Because
then I feel like, I've had like several conversations about this recently. Like, if you have to go into an office every day, like all day jobs tend to be exhausting because it's work, you know, you got to put a lot into it to do well.
Yeah.
But when you're in office every day, and I guess maybe in particular, if you have a little bit of introversion, to your makeup, like the expenditure of energy that is required by that, really increases the toll that it takes on you.
Yeah. You have to be on in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also feel like there's some kind of meeting in the middle that I'm trying to achieve right now where it's like, you can go to an office and be there for 8 hours and like go to 2 meetings, answer a couple emails and work on something. And that's, is honestly maybe like 3 hours worth of time you've actually spent being productive. And the rest is like, is not doing that, doing whatever else.
That's also so distracting. People are constantly interrupting you.
Yeah.
There's all these meetings and like weird, like, you know, round tables or whatever. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes they're productive, but other times you're like, I could be getting shit done right now.
Yeah. But it's like you are at least working. Like the people that are paying you are like, they're doing something that I can look at and see that they're working.
Right.
So it's like a 3 hour work day. But then it's like, I have a, you know, it should be an 8 hour day. So, but 3 hours of working from home productivity just doesn't feel like enough. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I'm pushing myself a little bit more right now too.
I get it. But I also think like there's different like levels of productivity within a time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're really focused for 3 hours,
mm-hmm.
like no social media, no phone, no internet, and you're just locked in.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, better than spending 6 hours where you're sort of in and out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You
I
know?
Was super duper focused for 6.5 hours yesterday and it was amazing. And I wish I could do that every day. Yeah, like Monday, I was also staring at a computer, like just trying to find my way into something for so long. And like, it just was not very productive.
You're never going to bat 1,000. You're just going to have like, there's days that are going to be great in that respect. And then there's days where you're like, look up and it's like 4:30 and you haven't gotten a goddamn thing done.
Yeah, yeah. I put pressure on myself to bat 1,000. So there's always that voice in my head that's like, you just do the 1,000 again.
Right.
You do it. And I'm like,
well, it's good to have goals, right?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the new book.
Thanks, brother.
On the kid, on the, like, you know, the successful move to LA, and good luck with the next one? Oh, you said it's a YA book about the kid with the seizures.
Yeah, yeah.
What about, like, are you doing any Hollywood stuff? Do you have those aspirations? Like, do you screenwrite or anything? Being in close proximity?
I'd like to. I'm hoping that it seems like Black Card, my new book, might be opening some doors. I don't want to, I don't know. I'm very wary of being yet another person in LA that's like, yeah, I'm about to break into Hollywood. Sure.
Got a pilot.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have any like spec scripts sitting around. That would be something I'd like to try right now. My creative energy is just going into like prose, like essays, fiction, all that stuff. Eventually I would like to do that. And I'm hoping I have a film agent through my literary agency who's like trying to get the book optioned. And I'm wondering if that might be the thing that helps me to give that a shot.
Cool, man. Well, yeah. I wish you the best of luck. And thanks. Thanks again for making time to come talk.
Brad, thanks for having me by.
All right, folks. There's Chris L. Perry. His new novel is called Black Card. It's out there from Catapult Press. Go get your copy right away. You can find Chris online at chrislperry.com. His Twitter handle is @ChrisLTerry. Once again, the novel is called Black Card. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music, as always. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you want to support this program, throw a few bucks in the hat, tip your server. You can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Don't forget to rate and review this program on iTunes if you have a couple minutes. It helps the cause. If you'd like to write to me, my email address is letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think. Tell me a story. Share your feelings.
Fuck you!
This program has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. It's free. It's a great way to listen. Go get the app. It's available wherever you get apps. Next week on the program, I will be talking with R.O. Kwan. So get ready for that. One of our more exciting young novelists. Summer's almost over. Where did it go? Oh my God, we're all gonna die.